Hey, I'm Bob Runkle, and for as long as I can remember, I've loved pop culture. Despite the challenges I've faced in my life, pop culture has always been there for me. I love talking to people and being a platform for others to share their thoughts and stories. Because if there's one thing I never get tired of, it's seeing driven, talented, and inspiring individuals follow their dreams, no matter what obstacles are in their way. And I know a thing or two about that. Welcome to the DJ Bob Show. I'm DJ Bob. Roll it.
The DJ Bob Show. Pop culture, past, and present. And now, here's your host, DJ Bob.
What can I say about Bill Sherman? Hamilton, In the Heights, Sesame Street, Don Quixote, and just a wonderful guy. We talked to him about it all, and it kind of goes all over the place. And I love it, and I hope you do too. Enjoy. I'm so excited to have you back here. It's been a little bit.
Absolutely, but you've been busy. Your social media tells all the things.
Thanks for keeping up with us here.
Of course.
It's cool. So for those that don't know who you are, would you mind giving a quick little elevator pitch?
Sure. My name's Bill Sherman. I, among other things, am the music director of Sesame Street. I also write songs for a number of cartoons, including Nature Cat for PBS and Don Quixote. I'm also the executive music producer of the In the Heights film and the soundtrack and the upcoming Tick, Tick, Boom film for Netflix. And I'm a parent. I have two small children who are 8 and 10. And I guess that's it.
Well, that pretty much sums it up. So how did you get to be doing all of those things? What were your beginnings?
Sure. Let's see. I grew up on Long Island. I was a big music fan. I played the saxophone. That was sort of my thing for a while. I was into jazz and hippie bands and rock bands that had saxophones in them. I went to Wesleyan University in 1998. I studied music there, West African music particularly. I went to Ghana my junior year of college to study music there. I met Lin-Manuel Miranda when I was 19 or 20, I think. And he asked me to music direct one of his musicals. And we started working together. We graduated from college. He was a substitute teacher. I was a computer tech at MTV. And during our lunch breaks, we would work on In the Heights at the Drama Bookshop, the now new Drama Bookshop, used to be the old Drama Bookshop. We developed In the Heights for a number of years. It went to Broadway in 2008. We did that for a little bit. He went on to do Hamilton. I went on to work at Sesame Street for a while, amongst other things. Then what happened? And then Hamilton happened and sort of blew the whole world up, and we produced that record. And then fast forward till now, we just came out with the In the Heights film, completing a sort of 20-year odyssey of craziness, and here we are. I guess that sums it up. I mean, some other things happened along the way.
Yeah.
I had a kid. I had two kids. Not that I personally had them, but there's two kids. And, I moved around a couple times, and here I am.
So what is it like sort of like producing the Hamilton record? Because it's the one thing before Disney Plus that put Hamilton into everybody's ears, you know? Mm-hmm. What's it like producing a cast album that will last?
I guess at the time of making it, you don't know. I mean, when we made the Hamilton cast record, it was like just Hamilton had been off Broadway. Had moved to Broadway and was just like the excitement was like pretty palpable. And then I think in the past, when you make cast recordings, it's just you want to capture what's on the stage and just sort of have that for posterity and archive and whatever. And I think what Atlantic Records and the producers wanted us to do was to make like a record as opposed to just making an archive. And so we went out of our way to really record it like a record. We took our time with it. We didn't sort of just like set up a couple microphones in a room and press record. And, you know, we brought in some heavy artillery, including the Roots, to sort of work with us to give it, you know, as much of a hip hop vibe as we could. We mixed it for a long time, and we brought in really heavy guys to mix it and master it. And we really spent our time making what I think is like not only a good capture of the musical itself, but is its own thing. And it was a really gratifying experience, and it was really fun. I think the best thing we did is we really had a good time making it. And it's so much music that it at times was like fairly overwhelming just because there's so many songs and so much music. But for the most part, it was a really enjoyable experience.
Be thankful you didn't add that finale thing.
Yeah.
It would have been another track.
That's right.
And probably when you're doing all the mixes, you don't need another one.
That's right. I couldn't stand any more music with that one. It was a long one.
So when you know, Hamilton becomes this big thing, Hikes was huge too. And we'll get into that because Hikes is in the zeitgeist for everybody. I mean, Hikes was my first cast album when I was 13 years old. Because I saw the Tonys that Sunday and then bought it the Tuesday. So I was engrossed in it when nobody knew who Lin was, when nobody knew who you were, at least in my area. So bringing Hike to the screen, were you hesitant?
No, I don't think hesitant. I think I was just like super excited. I was also just, I don't know what the right word is. I guess worried, skeptical. You know, it's just something that you started so long ago. And for me, it's like not only do I associate In the Heights with like my first major job, my first musical, my first big experience in entertainment. I was also a kid, and I can also like track my life, other life events to what I was doing at In the Heights while these other things were happening, which is very surreal. But then when it was time to put it on the screen, you know, you just like how In the Heights was successful as a musical, a theatrical musical, it was about this team of me and Lynn and Alex and Tommy Kail and Kiara and Andy Blankenbuehler. And then for the movie, it was the same thing. It was me and Alex and Lynn and Kiara. And then like John Chu, who was the director, who came in with like this very distinct vision of what the movie should be. And we sort of like got on his back and rode his idea all the way to the end. And it was a really interesting experience to take something that I had so become part of my DNA and really rethink it, not only sonically, but like the breadth of it and what it meant to people and what it means now versus what it means then. And then also like digging into my experiences over the past 20 years to really make the best version of In the Heights as humanly possible, which is certainly the movie.
Is there anything that you necessarily like better in the movie soundtrack than the Broadway cast recording?
I think like, you know, when we made the movie, we had the ability to just be grander and bigger. So like something that was a synth patch on a keyboard in the musical, because we could only use what's in the pit, is like a full orchestra, right? So like the breadth of it is much bigger. And then what we were able to do for the film is we brought in like really heavy hip hop producer and really heavy Latin producer to sort of really get those types of music to sing. So like 96,000 and the opening and blah, blah, blah are produced. We produced with Mike Elizondo, who's this famous hip hop producer. And then the Latin stuff was produced with this guy named Sergio George, who's this famous Latin music producer. And so having their expertise sort of intertwined with what we did for the Broadway versions really made it sort of jump off the screen, jump into your lap and get it, you know, really make it the 2.0 version.
So when you got the cast in to record, was it like kind of like Wow, we're actually doing this sort of deal.
Yeah, so we brought in a lot of the original cast, the original Broadway cast, to do a lot of the ensemble stuff, and they were all pretty much freaking out. And then the people who were new at it, it was interesting, similar to you, like the kid who played Sonny in The Heights was the first musical he ever saw, and so he has a relationship to it. And then, you know, the woman who played Vanessa, like, she's from Mexico, but she had a certain relationship in Heights. And weirdly, the majority of the people involved had a very specific relationship to it, as did I. And so we would all share those kind of stories and stuff, which was really fascinating. And it gave everybody like a very distinct way in, like a very distinct way to contribute to the overall movie, because they all came from different backgrounds, but yet all had this musical in common and all wanted to make the best story possible. So I feel like all of those things combined together really made the best product.
I mean, I loved it. It was so cool. Did you see the picture I posted of like the side by side of like the cast recording and the soundtrack? I think I tagged you in it or something.
Yes, I think I did. It's wild, right? How much time has gone by in between those two things. But you know what's interesting is they both sound similar. The songs still remain very intact.
But even then, when I was listening to it, it was still current, but now it's even more, I could even hear it more on Top 40 radio or Latin radio. It's just the new mixes and the new production adds a whole new breath to it.
Mm-hmm. Right? For sure.
So I kind of wanted to dive in deep with you about children's television for a little bit. And you've worked on Sesame Street for what, 13 years?
I think this is 11. 12.
I just didn't know the timeline. So did you have a chance to, and I wanted to ask you this when it happened, but did you have a chance to work with Adam Schlesinger?
I did. So Adam, this is a funny story. I got nominated for a Tony for In the Heights. And for all these award shows, there's like a lunch or something before they happen. And so I was seated at a table next to Adam Schlesinger at the Tony luncheon. So he was there for Crybaby, I think. And we were sitting next to each other. We were shooting the shit. And then I said, I'm the music director of Sesame Street. He said, no way. That's the coolest job ever. And I was like, well, you're in Fountains Wayne. And I think that's the coolest job ever. And so we got to talking. We exchanged numbers. And then projects would come up at Sesame Street that I thought he'd be great for. And he would write songs for us. So he did a song for Brad Paisley. He did a song. The original Elmo, the musical, the theme song he wrote. And then he did a song called I Wonder that Ernie wrote.
That's my favorite.
And he's this amazing, amazing songwriter, amazing, amazing human being, and sadly left us, you know, a year or so ago. And it's one of the saddest things ever. We hadn't worked together in a while, but he is one of the best songwriters that I know, and one of the best people that I knew, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, because a month prior to his death, we spoke with Tom Everett Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that thing you do and how that was Adam's first thing. And then a month later, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible.
I just wanted to bring that up to you because we haven't talked since. So, and so as far as Sesame Street, does the journey start a little bit earlier at a metric company?
Yeah, so what happened was in the early days, before all of the In the Heights stuff, we did Freestyle Love Supreme, you know, which is that hip hop group that I play in, where we get suggestions from the audience and make up hip hop songs. When the Electric Company was starting out, the woman who's the executive producer of the Electric Company, her name is Karen Fowler, had come to see Freestyle Love Supreme and wanted to sort of base the new Electric Company off of the, I don't know, improvisatory nature of Freestyle Love Supreme. So we got involved very early and we were like in the early pilots of the new Electric Company and blah, blah, blah. And then when it got picked up by Sesame Workshop, I somehow, I was really young. I had no idea what I was doing. I sort of parlayed that into being like, hey, can I be the music director? And they were like, okay, but being like, but knowing full well that I had no idea what I was doing. So I sort of learned on the job, and we made like 60 episodes of The Electric Company in a year and a half. And it was just like a full on crazy experience. And I was there, And then as The Electric Company was sort of shutting down, Sesame Street was looking to overhaul their thing. So the music department, so the guy who, you know, the original music supervisor who also passed away a few years ago was Danny Epstein. And he had been there since 1969. And so it was a humongous shoes to fill for sure. And yeah. And then I sort of interviewed there for a year or so and then finally got the job there. And I've been there ever since in what is still to this day the most surreal job title I think a person can possibly have. So,
and at the most surrealist place.
Absolutely.
Which is very funny because if I remember correctly, you did not grow up watching The Street.
That's right. It's one of my sad admittances is that I was like a G.I. Joe Thundercats kind of guy. And so,
I mean, that's cool too, but
I thought so, but you know, so it, like, and I think I told you the story last time we spoke, which is people will ask me all of this very insider baseball knowledge about Sesame Street. And initially I had no idea what they were talking about because I didn't watch it. And now of course I do because I've been there in a long time.
Yeah. But what did you know
about Sesame Street?
Yes.
Oh, I mean, I know about the puppets and I knew about, you know, I knew about, the people who were there, and I knew about some of the songs. Like, you know, like growing up, if you ever get into Stevie Wonder, you undoubtedly Google Superstition. And if you Google Superstition, what comes up is Stevie Wonder performing on the set. Yeah, it's one of the best things ever. And it's all these kids just sitting around while they're playing through Superstition. Super cool. And I felt like that was dope. And then Billy Joel playing Just the Way You Are, I think, or something like that. And like
Ray Charles,
like people who I grew up with, you know, and loved, and then they were on Sesame Street. And then when it got later, it was like NSYNC and Destiny's Child and, you know, Feist and all of those other things. And so then, you know, and then when I got the job, I went on a full deep dive and just sort of listened to everything and, you know, really got as much of it into my bones as possible.
So what are some of your favorite songs you've written?
I mean, I've written so many. The ones I like the most are like the ones that I didn't expect to be great. So like Janelle Monáe, The Power of Yet, and Bruno Mars, Don't Give Up. And I will say that the first song I ever wrote, second song I ever wrote for Sesame Street was What I Am, the Will I Am song. And I just, you know, we just wrote it as like a, could be a cool song, and it wound up being this great anthem. And it's one of the things that I get asked about most.
It ended up being on the Macy's parade.
And people perform it at preschools and kindergartens and things. And that's always very gratifying. And then more recently, like I just did a song with Dave Grohl about traveling across the country with Big Bird. And that was really fun too. And he's a super great guy. And it's, you know, I think the best thing about Sesame Street is people have their own relationship to it and really want to, when they're invited to be on it, really want to do great. And so you have people who are really at the top of their game coming to participate, which is wonderful.
One of the kind of more funny, is just because of style, is the Nick Jonas.
Oh, well,
yeah.
So I wrote that. I remember, so one day, if I can find it, I'll send you the demo of me singing that song. But I remember that we booked Nick Jonas and I got sent these lyrics about the Shape song. And at the time, he was like transitioning between the Jonas Brothers and his solo career. And he had all this like super like R&B type pop. And I was like, I can write songs like that. But I said that to myself. That doesn't mean that I like really could. And then it just, that song, that's like I was talking about before, like a surprise. Like I wrote that song in like 10 minutes because I just like, I knew what it had to be. And so like, you know, when you figure it out in your head, this is what I do is like, I'll walk around and I'll whatever. And if I figure it out in my head, I'll sing it into my phone. Then I'll come downstairs to my studio and do it. So usually that whole process, if I'm really nailing it, takes like 15 to 20 minutes. And so I wrote Check That Shape like in 15 or 20 minutes because I just knew what it had to be. And then I sent it to Chris Jackson to sing just so I could have like a good singing voice on it. And he said back this, you know, he had embellished a few things, but like, it was super cool. And so, you know, that's kind of the song that went to print. And then I remember going into the studio in LA with Nick Jonas, and I had no idea what to expect. And he was like the most professional and like incredible singer I had ever worked with up until that point. Like he was like, I call him the vocal assassin, because like, he just sort of like came in and had these like parts in his head, and he like heard it and he just nailed it. And I was so impressed. And he was really just a joy to work with and really nailed the song.
So when you're recording with these celebrities, don't name names obviously, but is there ever like a celebrity who, I don't want that sort of like treats it like a kid show, or are they all pretty cool?
They're all pretty cool and they're all pretty into it. What I do say to them, I was like, hey, don't treat this like a kid show. Just treat it like you're recording your next album.
Yeah, that's good.
And the other thing that I say to them is like, I want this to be as fun an experience for you as possible. So like, if there are things you want to add to the song or embellish or create, like, I'm totally into that. And most of them are just so happy to be on the show that they just crush it. Like, and they will do it on their own in their own studios at home. One celebrity recorded like in the basement of Madison Square Garden before a show. A couple of them, did it on their tour buses. Like, they'll do whatever you want because they're so happy to be there. So it's great. Oh, Macklemore, he arrived at like 7 a.m. to like record the vocal because he was so into it and wanted to be there and stuff like that, you know? So
that's fun. Yeah. So, yeah,
it's great.
Because, you know, when not much now, but like when some people hear a kid's show, they think of this like condescending, cutesy thing. And you never know what people are going to think. So that's like a question I had as far as how people treat it, because it is an important part of our culture.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. When I took the job, I did two things. One is I totally overhauled the department. And two was like, I think when people talk about Sesame Street, I think they get a certain sound in their head, which was the sound that Joe Raposo created, and, you know, years ago, which is like that sort of vaudevillian, like jazzy something or other, like,
which is great,
which is awesome. But I definitely pay homage to that, and we definitely still do write songs like that. But what I wanted to do was write songs for Sesame Street and redefine it as something that my kids would listen to on the radio. And this thing I always say, which is what I do, is every time I write a song, I play it for my kids to see if like it sticks to them, because I find that those are the most successful songs. And if they're singing it 5 or 10 minutes later, then I feel like I've really succeeded both as parent and as songwriter, because then, you know, they're learning something and they think my melody's good because they listen to pop music all day. So for something to actually stick to them sonically is a great achievement.
And I don't think, rarely on Sesame Street, there are like auto-tuned vocals unless you're doing a style parody.
Yeah. We did one thing, I remember, with the teeth brushing with Elmo, where we auto-tuned his vocal. Yeah. But for the most part, no, we don't auto. We tune some things just to nail the pitches, but there's not a lot of processing done at all.
And tell me about like from demo to final delivery, that process.
So the way it works with Sesame Street is a lot of the scripts, the lyrics are written by the script writers. I'll be handed scripts or pages of lyrics and, you know, see where they're set and what's happening. Like, if something's set on a farm, do I go more bluegrass or country? Or if something's set in a whatever, you know? And so then I figure out what kind of song it is to me. And then I sort of go through my Rolodex of composers, my Sesame Street composers, and figure out like who writes the best version of this song. So like, if it's a pop anthem, I go to my pop anthem guys. If it's like a vaudevillian thing, I go to my vaudeville guy. And then if it's something I like, then I'll write it. And so I figure that out and I send it to them, or I do it and I write it and we get it back, and goes to the producers who, you know, either confirm or deny that it's good. We figure out what it's shooting. We blah, blah, blah. Then we record all the vocals. And then it goes into post. And when it goes into post, it comes back to me. And then the Sesame Street band, which has been the same 10 guys for 10 for 12 years, records it. And then we sort of match it together with the vocals and put it to film and mix it and master it and get it out the door. That's pretty much the process. That being said, that process takes like, you know, 9 months, but between demo, filming, editing, mastering, you know, but, yeah. But that's pretty much it.
And I bet that was a learning curve during these times that we're living in right now.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a learning curve to begin with, but now we record remotely. So the drummer records and then the bass player records and then we marry those together and then the horns do it. So it's become quite a process, but we done it. And now it seems it's very efficient at this point. You know, after 12 years, you sort of figure out how something works. So now we've got it, but it took a while for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. So most recently, we've done some interviews regarding Don Quixote. And you want to talk a bit about that show and what musical palette that is and what's that like? Because that's, sure, that's a little younger, so to speak.
So I've been working a lot with Spiffy Pictures, who also do Nature Cat and also do Don Quixote. And for those that don't know, Spiffy Pictures is run by the Rudman brothers. Adam Rudman is a television writer. His brother, David, is also a television writer, but more famously is Cookie Monster and a bunch of things with the Muppets. But they make incredible shows. They teamed up with Fred Rogers Productions to make Don Quixote. What Don Quixote is about a girl donkey puppet, or a girl donkey who's also a puppet, and her misadventures with her friend Purple Panda. And it's very well done. It's very smart. It's very funny. It's one of my favorite things that I do. And sonically speaking, when I first started talking to them, I was like, you know, I know what Fred Rogers sounds like in the same way I kind of knew what Sesame Street sounded like, but I wanted to make something that was different. And so like for some reason, and I don't know why this is, but like sort of like 70s era soul sprinkled with like acoustic pop singer songwriter kind of all mushed together to sort of create what Don Quixote is. And I don't know that I set out to do that, but like as I sat down to write the songs, that's sort of just like what it became. And the good part, one of my favorite parts about working with them and Fred Rogers is like they love humor. And so anytime I could write a song that led to the funniness, if you will, of it all, like that to me was the most successful thing. And so I try to find like the funniest genres that I possibly can, or maybe a genre that doesn't necessarily fit what you might think, so that it comes as a surprise. And I think that sometimes makes for the best possible song.
One of my favorite songs from the show so far, because it's still going, is one of the puppeteers wrote, Mel Campbell. Mm-hmm. The Bobsky Bounce. That was so fun.
Yeah, it's a great song. Mel came out of nowhere. He was like a puppeteer. He was like a helper puppeteer. And then he told them he could write music. I got on the phone with Mel. We talked for a while. And now he writes for Sesame Street, too. And he's a very, very talented guy and the nicest guy ever. So, yeah.
Yeah, but that had, like, such a poppy feel to it. Like,
absolutely.
There aren't a lot of, like real pop songs on that show. It's more, like, folky and acoustic, like you said. And then there's the sleepover song, mm-hmm, and the gamble for the soul.
Yeah.
Part of it. But that's fun. So what is it like recording? How do you record those tracks? Because that's a lot of remote stuff.
Yeah. So the way that works is we have a vocal coordinator. Her name is Crystal Hall. She's incredible. She will Skype or whatever, Zoom with everybody in Chicago and in the recording studio, make sure that they get the vocals. And then all of the songs for Don Quixote, I make on my computer for the most part. Sometimes I bring in people to do certain things like play the piano or the guitar or something like that. But for the most part, I make them all here. And that seems to work so far. And it's pretty convincing that it just comes from a computer, even though it sounds like it doesn't. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Can we talk about the theme song specifically? Because there aren't a lot of theme songs these days that basically tell the story of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that does it quite well. You want to talk about that?
Sure. The Don Quixote theme song, the lyrics are, I think Adam and David wrote them. They sent them to me. And then I went back and forth on just like a couple different ideas. And finally, the thing that I came up with, that the what exists now, I don't know. I that was another one of those things. It was really fast. I think I wrote it at my, I have a grand piano upstairs in my house. I think I was there and I just sort of figured out the melody and what the chords were. And then I came downstairs and then this is pretty cool. I made friends with this guy who's this incredible bass player out of New Orleans. And I was like, hey, would you be interested in working on this? And I sent it to him and he put this whole band together and he sent it back and it sounded fantastic. And, you know, sometimes you get lucky with things like that. And, you know, and at that time, because of COVID and everything, like it needed to be a satellite situation where somebody could sort of just do it like a remote setup. And so they just did it. And he lives like he had lived inside the recording studio, like in another room, and did the record all the music and sent it back. And it was incredible. And it's truly fun experience. Kevin Scott is his name. I was liking. He's like a jam band bass player. And he put this together. And
that's
he
awesome. Did
a great job. Yeah.
Now, was anything with Donkey done pre-COVID? Because a lot of it seems to be done during COVID. And
yeah, I think they stopped shooting for a long time. And then once they finally got the go-ahead, went back into shooting. But all of Donkey, I believe, was done during COVID. We recorded the vocal is recorded and was recorded in somebody's apartment. It's all been done like in studios like this or just with very few people.
Yeah, because when we spoke with Haley and Frankie, they were in their dressing rooms shooting. Uh-huh. So it was, we caught them, but yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I wanted to bring up to you today specifically was a song from the Electric Company. We're going back a bit, so get into your
time capsule or time machine.
So, Silent E.
Oh,
with
yeah,
James Monroe Iglehart.
Yeah,
how did that come about? Because you have been doing freestyle stuff with him.
Yeah,
right?
So that's a great story. So Silent E, by all accounts, is the first song I ever wrote. And I wrote it in my bedroom in an apartment I lived in on Lower East Side. And Chris and I were together, and Chris Jackson, and he was like, what if it's like a Stevie Wonder thing? So I literally just sat down and started playing that, and he started singing that. And then it sort of just happened. And then James and Chris had met in a production in California on some musical something or other. And then James was going, this was like early days of Aladdin. And he would like been doing workshops of Aladdin. And then he came to New York to do something. And that's how he became part of the Electric Company and part of Freestyle Love Supreme. But before that, they were like, blah, blah, blah. What if James is Silent E? So he went into the studio and we recorded James is Silent E and he just killed it. And it became this sort of calling card for him. To this day, he still says, you know, he's like, I'm the genie from Aladdin. I'm this, 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 and that. But the thing that most people remember me for is Silent E, which I think is hilarious. And it was one of the first songs I ever wrote. And it was just, again, one of those things where funny enough, when I sit down to play the piano and I just need to do something with my hands, that's Silent E is the first thing I play. Just because, you know, like, it just makes sense to me.
It's so funny how I discovered it. Because I was a fan of the chorus that was used in the chorus of Kids that was used in the video, and mm-hmm. they did like a video shoot, and that's how I discovered what the Electric Company was.
That's wild. Yeah. So it was a fun show, and like what a weird introduction into kids music. Like I never set out to be involved with kids music. It just sort of happened for me that way. And so
I feel like that's when kids music got cool. Like there were things before that, but like when kids music started adopting like the top 40 styles and kind of digging deep into the archives, that's really when it got cool.
Well, I'm glad you think so. You would know. You know more about kids music and kids shows than anyone I know. So that's a compliment, I suppose. Thank you.
Well, I'm very proud to be knowledgeable because there are some things that I can't stand.
Oh yeah, of course.
In kid music, Like when, unless it's like, just like that QQ, like the vaudeville, like sometimes it works, other times it just doesn't.
I think it's patronizing sometimes. Like I think people right. have an idea of what kids' music should be, and it's sort of like too kiddy or too
or
too
do this kids-y and or, do yeah. do this and do that. When it becomes instructional, it kind of talks down
yeah.
to the audience.
And I always say with my composers, it's like, don't write a song like you're writing a song for a kid. Just write a song like you're writing a song for anyone. And hopefully it will come out, you know, as something that works for kids, but that isn't necessarily in that style, you know?
Yeah. And while we're talking about kids music, I want to talk to you about the Usher collaboration with you and Chris Jackson and the ABCs are moving. You would love that.
That's a good story. So
that had a life of its own too.
It did. And it yeah. So Chris, so we wrote an initial version of that song. And Usher was gonna come to the set and record it in like this truck that we had. And I wasn't there. So he got there. He listened to the song. He had not heard it. He listened to the song. He's like, all right, cool, but I want to do it this way. And he started just like beatboxing and clapping and whatever. So they recorded his version of the song and like literally 4 minutes later started to film it. And so I was on the phone with a vocal director named Paul Rudolph. And we were talking back and forth. We were like, what's he doing? Da, da, da. I think it's just going to be this. He doesn't want to sing the version of the song. Da, da, da. And so what came out with was essentially our melody and our song, but like with his own sort of groove and own sort of thing happening. And it actually wound up being really cool. I think, you know, most people know Usher for his like super produced, like smooth R&B yeah. stuff. And this was like, not that. It was like totally like bare bones, just like beatboxing and clapping. And it really was super fun. And people loved that song. And, you know, we write songs about the ABCs in kids' music all day long. And so for it to have some sort of fresh, different approach, I thought was really interesting. And it still to this day is another thing that people really love is that particular version.
I, because that's something that my niece really resonates. She always asked me to put it on. She was like,
it's a classic.
You guys are doing something right. So what are some of your favorite songs from other writers on the street? Because you've got this team. Do you want to highlight a few?
Sure. Some of my favorite guys. So there's this team called, J.P. Rendy and Catherine Rayo. They're particularly fantastic. They wrote that Brush song about teeth brushing. There's Toby Lightman. She had a bunch of songs in like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
And she's awesome. And then, you know, Greg Wells more recently. So Greg Wells produced The Greatest Showman. He did Stuff for the Heights.
Yeah.
Yep. And he's fantastic. He's been writing songs for us as well. He wrote a thing for Casey Musgraves. And then we just came out with this great song for Juneteenth that he wrote with his wife, Nina. Oh, and it's incredible. And then, who else?
Didn't Lack write a few too?
Lack has written a few songs over the years. Craig Thomas, who's the original showrunner.
Oh, we know him.
How I Met Your Mother, right? Who else? Eli Bolin, who's like a Broadway guy. Shayna Taub, who's also a Broadway person. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Those are the people.
What are some of, is there a song that came to you and sort of surprised you because you asked for one thing and then they just.
Oh, yeah. That happens all the time. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about Sesame Street. It's sometimes I will tell the composer what I think it should be. Other times I will go out of my way to not. So they'll be like, what should it sound like? And I'll be like, I don't know. And just to see what they come up with. And sometimes it will be totally off the mark. And that's rare because, you know, like I said before, we've been doing this for such a long time. People kind of know where the good spots to hit are. But sometimes it'll just come back and it'll be wrong. And like, I'll know it immediately. So I'll call them and be like, this is awesome. This just isn't right for this moment. And then more often than not, people just nail them. And I also don't like to give people too many pre-notes because I feel like that stumps creativity. You know, like if they're going to write, if they have an idea of what it should be, then who am I to tell them it's not that, you know? So that's how I kind of approach it.
Yeah, I love that. People don't seem to realize how adjacent Hamilton and In the Heights are to Sesame Street, even Freestyle Love Supreme.
Yeah.
What's it like bringing your friends in, and what are some of your favorite examples of that?
Well, I will say that it's wild to live in a world where, like, my job on kids' music, my work in theater, my work in performing in theater, producing records, and da-da-da, all is very weirdly intertwined. It's sad to say that the only time these days that I really get to see my friends is if I'm working with them. So I will go out of my way to figure out ways to make that happen. So bringing James onto Sesame Street or the Electric Company, and Chris as well, and Lynn, you know, so Lynn, initially Lynn got cast to be on Sesame Street, and then they called me to write the song for him for Sesame Street. And then since then he's written songs for Sesame Street just because I wanted him to, and he was into it. Same thing with Lack, and same thing with Chris and James, and, you know, even Anthony Viniziale from Freestyle Love Supreme, and he and I have collaborated on songs. Jelly Donut from Freestyle Love Supreme has as well. So I try to, you know, and then I get to hang out with them and I get to check in with them. Utkarsh Ambudkar, also from Freestyle, has written songs for Sesame Street and stuff like that. So, and working with Questlove Supreme, he's a big Sesame Street fan as well. And so he and I have worked on a number of projects together, including Sesame Street, which has been pretty great.
And even you brought, I think it was a couple months back, you brought in Anisha and Anthony to do a little video. Yep. That was fun.
Totally.
So that was like, was that like something like, oh, I want these two to do it, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the hip hop stuff, like when we're doing those battles for like, what do we call them? Elmo's rap battles. It bringing in my friends who are great rappers, you know, they're totally into it, and they love it as much as I do. So that's cool.
I love that. Like, that was so fun.
Because
it's like, it's interesting. People see me as this kid show encyclopedia, and you know I'm much more than that. But it's, but it's like, it's so cool to see my interests kind of cross over.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot on the street. So,
absolutely. Well, I'm glad. That means a lot coming for you. That's great.
So let's talk about Freestyle Love Supreme and, you know, finally bringing it to Broadway after, like, many iterations.
Yeah. So, you know.
Because you're coming back.
Yeah. And also, it just got announced a couple hours ago that we won a special Tony Award. That we're receiving a special Tony Award for Freestyle Love Supreme, which is pretty cool.
Congrats.
Yeah. You know, Freestyle Love Supreme was always this thing that I did with my friends for fun. You know, we just like, we made up raps and we hung out and we got to see each other. And then, you know, we made like 4 different television shows. One was, you know, sort of more of like us doing live stuff. One was more scripted. Like, we had all these television shows. None of them seemed to ever catch on as much as the live show did. So finally we're just like, screw it, let's do the live show on Broadway. And we did. And I'm amazed every night when I go play in that show and people are there, and we're going to go back this fall and do it again. And it's just, you know, again, it's another fun way to hang out with my friends. And I happen to be lucky enough that when I hang out with my friends, we get to do a show on Broadway, which just sounds absolutely ridiculous coming out of my mouth, but that's what it is. And that's how we work. And so, you know, whatever it takes for us to hang out.
And it's interesting because one of the members of the team is local to me, Kayla. We went to the same high school.
Oh, wow.
Sort of funny.
That's funny.
And we live like, we grew up like 5 minutes from each other.
That's wild.
So that was a fun chat. But like bringing those new members in, is that cool for you?
I love it. I feel like Freestyle Love Supreme is like a mecca of really talented people. And there's very few people in the world that can do that kind of stuff. And so bringing in new people and having like fresh takes on things and fresh blood and like fresh ideas is really cool. I love it. I every time somebody new comes into Freestyle Love Supreme, it's also good for me because it like makes me stay on my toes, you know, like I'm ready to sort of help compliment that person. And because they're always bringing something new and it's not just the same stuff we've been doing for like 100 years. So that I love.
That's awesome. And I hope that I can go see it when it,
it would be great to see you.
I don't know. Cause I've heard that the venue isn't wheelchair accessible.
Oh, I think it is. Is it not? You should call them.
I'm going to do that.
The booth. Yeah.
I want to make sure that I can get in
Get in there.
So what was it like randomly being roped into doing a podcast with Questlove?
Well, that story is fantastic. So he and I met doing the Hamilton cast record, and we were in the studio one day, and it came out that I worked for Sesame Street. And he said, "Oh my God, I want your job. You have the coolest job ever." And I said to him, "Oh my God, you have the best job. I want your job." And so we hung out during the record making process. And then he called me one night and he said, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow?" I was like, "I don't know. What am I doing tomorrow?" He's like, "You're the first guest on my podcast." And I was like, "Okay." And he was like, "Come to 30 Rock and we'll interview you in the band, where the Roots rehearse for the Tonight Show." So I went, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I was in there for like 4 hours. I thought it was going to be like an hour and a half. And so like for an hour and a half, we talked about Sesame Street. He played me some things from Sesame Street I'd never heard, blah, blah. And then for 3 hours, we just talked about anything else. And it was so funny and I couldn't stop laughing and I had no business really being in this room. And then like 2 weeks later, he called me back and he goes, "So you're going to be on the podcast full time. Just show up when I tell you to show up." I was like okay. And that was like 5 years ago. And so like since then, you know, we've interviewed everyone from like Dave Chappelle to, you know, he interviewed Michelle Obama.
Is that when you and I met?
Possibly.
Yeah. Okay, I think it just started.
Yeah, it was wild. And he... And you know, we've been all over. We went to Minnesota to interview, you know, the Revolution from Prince's Revolution. We went to LA to interview whomever. And we just do all this crazy stuff and we interview these great people. And it's really fun and exciting. And it's like just something I never thought I'd be involved with or had any business being involved with. And there I am.
I love it. And I'm an avid listener to it. It's very, okay. it's got a very fun atmosphere. And it's like, you're there, and that doesn't happen with a lot of podcasts. So
yeah, for sure.
So a couple quick hike questions before we wrap up here.
Okay.
What, you know, hearing Jimmy Smith sing one line, what that had quite the presence on social media, like were you there when he recorded? Like
I was. He's great. So Jimmy's one of the nice guys in the world. He does not consider himself a singer, but if you look at his TV history, there are parts of LA Law and parts of the West Wing where he does sing, just like randomly in the episode. So Lynn and I always used to watch the West Wing particularly and be like, "Oh, he can sing." But he came in, he was nervous. I just sort of sat with him for a while. We're like, "Dude, this is just like no problem, like blah, blah, blah." And he did that one line, but like 15 or 20 times. And then finally he nailed it and he got really confident. And then he would sing in like the background parts of Alabanza and other places. And he was just super into it. And he was super, you know, even at his experience level and professionalism, like he was still willing to take risks and take the plunge, as it were. And so he was game to do anything. And he said the nicest thing to me at the opening, the premiere, he said, "You know, all talents aside, like you just instilled with me a willingness to confidence to do this. And that was the best thing that I was taught during this," or something like that. And I was like, "Well, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. So thank you."
I love that, you know, because people are literally like losing their mind over that one.
I know. And he crushed it. It was great. It was really great.
And the other quick little thing I wanted to bring up is the new original song for the credits. almost summer. Like, when did you hear that, and what did you think of it?
So I heard an early Lin demo of it a long time ago, and he was like, Anthony's going to sing this, and Leslie's going to sing this, and then Mark Anthony's going to come out of nowhere, and he's going to sing this. And we were all like, okay. But, like, you know, sometimes when Lin makes a demo, it's very easy to hear the future. Sometimes it's not, blah, blah. And then he brought in this great producer named Truco, who does a lot of reggaeton stuff, and we all sort of developed it, and it turned out into the song. And it was a song initially where I was like, this is a perfect end credit song. And then the more and more you listen to it, you're like, actually, it's just a really good song.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's like one of those things where, like, three or four times you're just like, this is a great song. What can I say? And, like, and to Lin's credit, always, like, his ability to find rhythm and hookies and hooks and catchy stuff is just like, is, you know, genius in every level. And so that song, particularly for me, it was not something that I knew, thought that I would like, and now I sing it all the time. So,
and I think a lot of times there aren't movie songs nowadays that could be pop hits anymore, mm-hmm. like there used to be, but I feel like that's definitely one of them.
Absolutely.
That could be.
Absolutely.
So, if I remember correctly, Lin was and still is a big Rent fan.
Absolutely.
So, having Daphne Rubin Vega do vocals and just be in the film, what was that like for you guys?
So awesome. Because, like, every time she sings, all you can hear is Out Tonight, right? Even now, yeah. Like, 100 years later, every time she says anything, all you hear is "Take me out tonight," you know. And she's the nicest human being in the world. And, like, we are, like, we're so in love with her because, like, I saw the original cast of Rent in 1990, whatever, and she was there, and it was unbelievable. And so now she's just like, you know, when you are like a fan of someone, and then you go and it turns into being like a colleague and a friend, is like a really nice experience. And particularly with her, but she's just like, she's just down for it to be great. And Jimmy Smits was like that too. He's just like, he wanted to make the best possible thing. And so to have people like that who've had these, like, tremendous careers come in and, like, be as gung-ho as you are about the thing that you're making is just really cool. It's just really cool. And Daphne had seen In the Heights and, like, was part of the whole group, and she was just there, and her energy was right. And every time she's like, when she sang Carnival de Barrio, we were just like, holy shit, like, it was just, like, unbelievable, you know. So yeah, she's just one of the great greats.
I'm, you know, as soon as I saw that casting, I go, yeah, this is gonna be good.
Yeah, she's unbelievable, really unbelievable.
So, real quick, Tick Tick Boom,
that's coming. Yep, so Tick Tick Boom comes out in the fall.
And that's on a smaller scale, right? There isn't...
Yeah,
like, I mean... not like a big blockbuster, it's just a Netflix film, but tell me about that musical style, that palette real
quick. Sure. It's definitely like a big film. Like, Andrew Garfield is in it, and he's brilliant.
Yeah, but not to the... You know what I'm saying?
Yes, it's not like... It's strange to go from In the Heights to Tick Tick Boom, because they're very different. Absolutely. Sonically, so for those that don't know, Tick Tick Boom was what Jonathan Larson wrote before Rent. So there definitely is some, like, early Rent-y tendencies in Tick Tick Boom. But essentially it's about him turning 30 years old in 1990. So if you can put yourself where you were in 1990 and what the music sounded like, it's sort of like the musical theater version of that. And so there's some rocking, and there's some, you know, some synth wave, David Byrne type
very
stuff.
Very some, like, REM kind of stuff,
yeah,
too.
For sure. And so we took it and kind of turned it on its head and started to make it, like, big and, like, you know, grandiose as possible for that particular time, while still sort of living in, you know, his world of that time, you know. And still a lot of it takes place on a stage, so didn't want to get too big, like it was too big for the stage. But anyway, the music is, you know, his songs are unbelievable, so, like, turning each of the songs into, like, a pop hit was ultimately the challenge, and was ultimately really fun thing to do, and really, like, flush out everything and add more guitars and add more beats and stuff like that. And it's a really well-made film. And Lin is the director, and having this be his first thing was really fun and exciting thing to do, and a great way to sort of come down off of the In the Heights thing was to work on this sort of like what feels like an indie film with a non-indie film budget. So it's
it's more of a passion project, but not really a passion project.
It depends on who you ask. It's certainly a passion for him and certainly a passion for us too. Cause this is honestly, when Lynn and I were roommates in the early 2000s, we would listen to Tick, Tick, Boom all the time and sort of reenact it. And so like, this feels like the perfect, you know, ending to that particular scenario.
And that's coming out in the fall.
Yep,
on in the Netflix.
Fall. You got it.
I think it's got a small theatrical run too, if I'm correct.
I think so.
So where can people find you on the internet? Where can people connect with you?
I'm on Twitter, bsherman2222242s. Same thing on Instagram. And my website is popmusicmisery.com. So come say hello.
And I just want to thank you for always being supportive of our work and what we do here and connecting with us too. It's really awesome.
Bob, anytime. You're awesome. And I'm happy to talk to you whenever you want.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Bye, buddy.
The DJ Bob Show. Pop culture, past and present.